As number 13 begins, we find that the battle is about to be joined between the armies of David and the armies of his son Absalom, as Absalom carries out his military coup to wrest the crown from his father David. Remember that Ahithophel, David's old counselor, had given logical advice to Absalom. But through the providence of God and the intervention of God through Hushai, Absalom is following the counsel of Hushai. It will be his fatal mistake. We read in verse 6 that the people went out to the field against Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. But the armies of Israel, under the leadership of Absalom, were defeated as they fought their king in exile, and David prevailed, and the slaughter was great that day, 20,000 men. But the battle was spread over the entire country. As Absalom is riding along on his mule, he rides under a thick oak with great tangled branches, and his head and hair become caught in the limbs of the tree and the branches of the tree, and his mule keeps going, and Absalom is dangling and swinging helpless between heaven and earth. A man sees him hanging there and runs and tells Joab, and he says, "Captain Joab, I saw Absalom, and he's caught, and he's swinging like a pendulum under the limbs of a great oak." And Joab says, "Why didn't you kill him?" He said, "I would have given you pieces of silver and a belt if you had slain him on the spot." And the man told Joab, he said, "Even if I were to receive 1,000 pieces of silver, I would not put out my hand against the king's son." "Why do you think he said that?" Well, we know historically what David did to those who touched God's anointed. The Amalekite, the two that had killed Ishbosheth on his bed. And these events were not unknown, I am sure, to this young man engaged in the battle. And he was simply afraid to kill the king's son. But Joab is not afraid. Joab is a different cut of man. And we know those reasons from our previous studies. Joab said, "I won't waste time with you." And he goes and takes 3 darts or spears and thrusts them into the heart of Absalom while he dangled by his hair and head from the oak tree. Joab blows the trumpet. Victory has been gained. The leader of the military revolt has been slain. And they took him and they cast him ignominiously into a deep pit and put a big heap of stones over him. And all of Israel, in other words, the armies of Absalom, fled. And each man fled to his tent. A foot race ensues to run back and tell King David, as he sits by the gate in Mahanaim, that the battle has been won by Joab and his armies against Absalom. The first man to arrive on the scene does not tell David that his son has been killed. Remember, David had given specific instructions to his 3 generals back in chapter 18, verse 5, to deal gently with the young man Absalom. Joab's actions against Absalom were far from gentle. And the Cushite is the second to arrive, and he tells David, "May all the enemies of the Lord who rise up against you for evil end up as that young man ended up." And David knew immediately that his son Absalom was dead. And in verse 33 of chapter 18, the king was much moved. He went up to his private chamber, up over the gate in the city, and he wept, and as he went, thus he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son." His grief for Absalom is beyond the grief that he had exhibited for Amnon. His grief for Absalom is totally out of proportion with the character of Absalom. By this time in David's life, so much tragedy has befallen him and the members of his family that he's a devastated man psychologically. Remember how he behaved himself when the son born of Bathsheba died. He was a man in control. At this point in his life, the tragedy which has taken place has sapped from him that very character that made him the man that he was. And he is deteriorating rapidly, physically and psychologically. And now he begins to lament and mourn. And in chapter 19, verse 1, Joab is informed that the king is weeping and mourning, and Joab can understand this, how a man could weep and mourn for someone that was about to take his life and would have taken his life had he had the chance. And the victory that the armies of David enjoyed that day was turned to mourning because of David's improper reaction to the death of the man, although his son, who led the armies that were attempting to destroy him. As a result, the people sneak away from the victory celebration that had been planned, and they crept away, and it says, as if they had been cowards who turned their backs in the battle. And the king covers his face and screams and cries, "Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom!" Joab, never the one to be hesitant to approach the king, came up to him in his house and said, "David, today you have covered the faces of all your servants with shame. They have risked their lives. They have saved your life. They have saved the lives of your daughters and of your wives and your concubines, and they've saved your kingdom. And now by loving this man and these other individuals who hated you, and by hating those people who love you because Absalom has been killed, you have shown that princes and servants are nothing to you." And Joab says, "I believe that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you'd be happy." He says, "David, if you don't go out and speak kindly to these people that risked their lives for you, as the Lord lives, if you don't go out, not a man will spend the night with you, and this will be worse for you than all the evil that's come upon you from your youth until now." And it's almost as if he grabs David by the shoulders and shakes him to shake some sense into him and to bring him back to reality. And the king rises up and goes and sits in the gate. And word travels fast, and they say, "The king is sitting in the gate," and all the people came. And their spirits are renewed. David was still dwelling in the Transjordan, and a move is made by the people in the land to bring him back to Jerusalem as monarch. Part of this plan involves the selection of Amasa, the general of Absalom's army, who led the military revolt, to replace Joab as military leader of David's armies. This will not sit well with Joab, because he is a strong individual, and he will not receive this news lightly. David begins the journey back across the Jordan into the Cisjordan area, to take up his proper place on the throne in Jerusalem. The activities which went on during the journey back to Jerusalem are contained in chapter 19. It seems that no sooner has David arrived back in the land, and as soon as he has assumed his rightful place as monarch, a worthless man named Sheba attempts another military coup to take the throne and the crown from King David. This account is contained in chapter 20. I believe that Sheba took advantage of the tribal argument, which was in the previous chapter in verses 41 through 43. He leads the Israelites and says, "We have no portion in David, so every man to his tent." And now, all the men of Israel withdrew from following David, and they followed Sheba. But the men of Judah remained steadfast to the king, from the Jordan even to Jerusalem. David goes now to his house in Jerusalem, and he takes the 10 women, the concubines who he had left to keep the house, and put them under guard. These were the ones that Absalom had relations with in the view of all the city. And he provides them with sustenance, but they no longer serve as personal concubines to him in an intimate sense. And they were shut up until the day of their death and lived as widows. David now has a problem, an immediate problem. He is in the midst of another military revolt, and he must act quickly. He calls the new general that he has selected, Amasa. And he says, Amasa, get the men of Judah here within 3 days and present yourself. I'm ready. We have to go out and fight Sheba and the armies of Israel. So Amasa went to call the men of Judah, chapter 5 says, but he delayed longer than the set time which was appointed to him. This verse tells me a great deal about Amasa. Amasa is still loyal to the opposition. Amasa was the leader under Absalom of these very same people. Amasa is a disloyal general. This political move that David made to get himself reentrenched in his kingdom by selecting Amasa to replace Joab was a bad move tactically and strategically. David is in serious difficulty. He needs a general who can act quickly. He needed a man that would rally the armies of Judah within 3 days. And Amasa is dragging his feet. Joab, on the other hand, historically, even though I cannot condone his actions or his character, was a man of action. And I believe that had Joab been on the scene here, Joab would have had the armies of Judah standing before David, ready to march against the armies of Israel within 2 days, but not Amasa. David now says to Abishai, I can see now that Sheba is going to do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him. Abishai is Joab's brother. It is essential that he overtake Sheba and return him for trial and execution, or kill him before he finds a hiding place, or he could rally the nation from hiding like a revolutionary. At the same time, verse 7 says, Joab's men went out after him. And we read that Joab has with him these hired mercenaries that David has had around him through all these years, his personal elite corps of commandos. It almost appears that Joab and his men are chasing Sheba, and they encounter Amasa coming the opposite way, as if just now he's bringing the armies back to meet David. This would be a further indication of how much Amasa has delayed in gathering the armies. But at any rate, they met at the large stone which is in Gibeon, and Amasa came to meet them. Joab has his military attire on, and in his military attire was a belt and a sword and a sheath. And as Joab walks forward, the sword falls out on the ground. And I'm certain that when Amasa saw Joab's sword fall on the ground, he assumed that Joab was disarmed and would not do him any harm. But he did not know about the knife or the short sword which was in the hand of Joab. And when Joab and Amasa meet, Joab takes Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. And Amasa was not on guard. And he says, is it well with you, my brother? And as he kissed him, Joab let him have it with his sword in the belly. And he sliced open his stomach. And this Bible says that Amasa wallowed in his blood in the center of the highway. The pursuit of Sheba continues under the leadership of Joab. They arrive at the city where Sheba has taken refuge. They began to cast up a mound against the city. In other words, they were piling dirt up at an angle to get up to the top of the wall. They are laying siege to the city. They are hitting the doors and the walls with battering rams and are about to tear down the wall. In the city, there was a wise woman, and she says, "Tell Joab to come here that I can speak with him." He approaches, and the woman says, "Are you Joab?" He says, "I am." The woman tells him that that city in which she dwells has a reputation of being a city of wise people, because people used to say they will ask advice at Abel and end the dispute. The woman goes on to say, "We're peaceful and faithful." Joab said, "I don't really want to swallow up or destroy your city, but there's a man named Sheba who's hiding in your town. He has rebelled against King David. Hand him over, and we will depart and not destroy your city." Verse 21 says, the woman responded by saying, "Just wait a minute. We'll toss his head over the wall." In verse 22, the woman wisely came to the people, and they cut off the head of Sheba. They threw it to Joab. Joab blows the trumpet, and they return to the king at Jerusalem. Verse 23 says, Joab was over the whole army of Israel and the personal elite military troops. Joab has secured his place as military leader again. David is safe on the throne again after surviving two military rebellions, and things seem quiet for a while in the land of Israel. Chapter 21 contains the section we discussed previously regarding the Gibeonites and the attempt of Saul to exterminate the Gibeonites. In the remaining verses, we read that David took the bones of Saul and Jonathan from the men at Jabesh Gilead who had rescued them many years earlier from the wall at Bethshan. David took the bones and gathered the bones and buried them in the country of Benjamin, in the grave of Kish's father. Following this, David was forced to fight with the Philistines once again. We see now that David is old because he becomes weary during the battle. And one of the descendants of the giant, whose spear was 300 shekels of bronze in weight, had a new sword in his hand, and he attempted to kill David. I'm certain that he remembered what David had done years ago, and now this giant is about to get his revenge on King David. And David is no match for this man now. But Abishai, his nephew, helps him. Abishai strikes the Philistine and kills him. This prompts the men of Israel to say, "David, don't go out with us anymore to battle, because it's too risky. We're aware of the covenant that God swore with you. Don't go out in battle so that the lamp of Israel may not be extinguished." Chapter 22 contains David's song of praise. The psalm takes verses 2 to 51 in chapter 22. And parallels Psalm 18, verses 2 to 50. Chapter 23 confirms for us that David is the inspired writer of many of the Psalms. Read with me the first few verses of chapter 23. "Now these be the last words of David. David, the son of Jesse, said, and the man who was raised up on high, the anointed of the God of Jacob, and the sweet psalmist of Israel, said, the Spirit of the Lord spake by me, and his word was in my tongue. The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spake to me, he that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. And he shall be as the light of the morning when the sun riseth, even a morning without clouds. As the tender grass springeth out of the earth by clear shining after rain." Not only does David confirm the fact that God spoke through him, but he gives us the criteria for successful leadership. The balance of chapter 23 contains a recount of some of the historic activities of the valiant men under David. Some minor skirmishes and battles are detailed, and we see the bravery of some of the men of David when David was in the cave at Adullam. Chapter 24 details the activity of David in numbering the people. We read in verse 1 that the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and David said, "Go number Israel and Judah." 1 Chronicles 21:1 gives further insight into this incident when it indicates that Satan is the one that prompted David to number the people of Israel and Judah. David is old and evidently is beginning to lose some of the confidence that he had in God as the leader of the armies of Israel. As a result, he begins to think his strength comes in numbers rather than from God. This displeases God, but surprisingly enough, it displeases Joab as well. Because in verse 3, Joab resists. It is almost as if Joab is more spiritual than David and has more insight into God's purposes and plans than David. He says in verse 3, "The Lord will add as many people as you want, 100 times as many as they are. Why will the king delight in this thing? Why do you want to number the people, David? God will give you as many people as you need when you need them. So don't worry about this thing. Don't be concerned about the numbers, about the quantity." Verse 4 said, "The king's word prevailed against Joab and against the commanders of the army." David asserted his authority as king. He did not listen to his military men. So Joab went out from the presence of the king and began to register the people. This is a census. We are familiar with what is involved in taking a census. Things were slower then, and we find in verse 8 that it took 9 months and 20 days. It was a long job. They made a big circle throughout all the cities of the land. He came back and gave the numbers of the people to David. And now it appears that when Joab laid the figures before him, David knew that he had done wrong. And he said, "I have sinned. I see now that I put my confidence in numbers. Lord, take away the iniquity of thy servant. I have acted foolishly." David gets up in the morning, but God has anticipated this. The word of the Lord came to Gad the prophet. Gad came in and spoke to David and said, "David, I will take away your sin, but there's going to be a price to pay after your confession." We dealt with this before. The fact that because we repent and change does not alleviate or remove the damage which has been done. All of the people in the land have witnessed the fact that David shifted and began to put his confidence in numbers rather than God. The faith of every inhabitant of the land has been touched and affected because of David's lack of faith. How can this be removed in a moment? God has been offended. God's position in the nation of Israel has been diminished and reduced because of David's census. So even though David confesses and repents, the damage has been done and there's a price to pay. In effect, Gad says, "Pick a card, any card. You have 3 choices, David. God is going to give you 7 years of famine, or would you like to flee for 3 months before your enemies while they pursue you? Or would you like God to send 3 days of plague into the land? Select which one you want. But God must punish you." And notice, David is not the only one who will be punished. As the head of his people, his sin has caused his people to be punished as well. David says, I'm in great distress. I don't want famine. I don't want to flee before my enemies. It seems of all three of these things, it is much better to fall into the hand of the Lord, because his mercy is great. So the Lord sent a plague, and in the time of the plague, 70,000 men died from the far north to the far south. What a terrible thing! David's lack of faith and sin resulted in the death of 70,000 people. It is as if God said, David, you have put your faith in numbers and in quantity. I will show you how, at the stroke of my hand, I can remove the numbers from you. Your victory doesn't depend on numbers, David. I can give them, as Joab said earlier, or I can take them in the twinkling of an eye. David sees the angel of the Lord by Araunah the Jebusite near Jerusalem. Notice that the Jebusite is still around, close by Jerusalem. David pleads with the angel, and he says, it is I who have sinned. What have these people done? Let your hand be against me and my father's house. But it could not be, because David was the recipient of the Davidic covenant. His house could not be cut off, so the other people had to be smitten. The prophet Gad came to David that day and said, erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. And quickly David goes up according to the word of Gad and follows the commandment of God. He buys the threshing floor from Araunah and builds an altar and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. Verse 25, the last verse in chapter 24, the last verse in 2 Samuel says, and David built there an altar unto the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. So the Lord was entreated for the land, and the plague was stayed from Israel. It is evident that the book of 2 Samuel takes less than 40 years. We know that David was 30 years of age in 1010 when the book of 2 Samuel began. David reigned for 40 years. David is still on the throne as 2 Samuel comes to an end. And although David is an old man, the book has taken less than 40 years. It is necessary to go to 1 Chronicles chapter 22, beginning in verse 1, for the remainder of David's life, which is not covered in the book of 2 Samuel or in the initial portion of 1 Kings chapter 1.